The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Sonal Shah, Executive Director of the Beek Center at Georgetown University, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
The Beck Center at Georgetown University embraces a cross-disciplinary, citizen-centric approach to building solutions for communities. And it is led by a woman who is a living embodiment of that, with stints at the Treasury Department, Goldman Sachs and Google, and is the founder and director of the Office of Social Innovation and Civic Participation during the Obama administration. She is Sonal Shah, the executive director and professor of practice at the Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation at Georgetown University. Good evening, Sonal, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Denver, it is so great to be here and so great to meet you. You're a legend.
Sure I am. Tell us about the Beck Center, how it got started, and its of its mission and purpose.
Well, the Beck Center at Georgetown was founded by a very generous grant from Alberto and Olga Maria Beck, who are alumni of Georgetown. And it was really a center to think about how to teach students to solve for social problems and teaching them not only how to do it from a practice perspective. We teach classes on solving impact at scale, but we also do research on what are the systems that need to change? What are the financial models? How do you use data and technology in today's time? And how do you make sure citizen feedback is part of every problem we're solving and making sure that it's actually solving it for people, not just for the policymakers? So it's been great. It's been great to be there. And we are really focused on how do we scale solutions that work in communities that can have real impact on lives.
Fantastic. You were the Director of Social Innovation and Civic Participation in the White House during the Obama administration. What was the impetus for starting that?
Similar to kind of the Beck Center, we were thinking as the government was coming in, we were looking at innovation and policies. I led the president's advisory board in the start during transition on technology, government innovation. And one of the areas that we really focused on was social innovation. So if we really want to solve social problems, we're going to have to think differently. You can't just use the same tools that we've been using for 25 years and saying we're going to get a different result because times have changed, not because the ideas are bad, but because times have changed. And social innovation was really thinking about how does government think differently about solving problems? How do we partner with communities? How do we do effective public-private partnerships? How do we use innovative mechanisms like pay for success, social impact bonds to actually solve problems? And that was our goal.
Well, changing government policy is a big, big deal. And that's, of course, going to depend on having good information. How can research be assembled in an intelligent way to best inform government about policy?
One of the most interesting things that's happened in the last 20 years is access to data has become much more available. We have more information on what's happening in cities, in communities, in states. And collecting that information and knowing what's happening in each of those cities and communities, states, and knowing what works and what doesn't work allows us to make smarter policy. The challenge for government, and especially at the federal level, is you don't want to make policy for one idea. You need to make and ensure that it's not affecting someone inadvertently across the board. But collecting that information, collecting that data, and knowing where it's working and then changing policy to allow and accelerate that change is what policy can do and it has the potential to do.
You know, we've had a lot of social entrepreneurs on this show, and invariably when I talked to them about their work, they said they all wanted to do it without government at first. But invariably they come back and say, boy, if I'm ever really going to make any kind of change that's a big deal and has any impact, I can't exclude government from the equation. So the question then really becomes about the 21st century public sector. It's hard to change the public sector. A lot of us don't think about the public sector and innovation in the same breath. What are some of the things that you've done to make it to create a culture of innovation, to see that it's human-centric and that is really focused on outcomes?
So three things. One, just teaching even government officials how to do innovation. We used to run a council when we were at the White House that just allowed executives, but also civil service to work together and saying, what are innovative ways agency A is doing versus agency B? So as Health and Human Services is doing something really cool or DOD is doing something really interesting, are there ways to learn from that to make that happen? So just across the board, making it available and opportunistic for government to be able to do that. And I'll give you a great example. Veterans Affairs, when Shinseki was head of Veterans Affairs, he ran this competition internally for how to make Veterans Affairs work better.
Uh-huh.
He had 30,000 ideas from internally itself for how they can improve services for veterans from Veterans Affairs. Everyone from a doctor to someone running a technology system to somebody working in a hospital.
They were waiting to be asked.
They were waiting to be asked. And so giving people the permission to think creatively and innovatively to solve problems is one way of doing it. Secondly, it's giving them the tools to be able to try new things, whether it's pay for success, whether it's impact investing, public-private partnerships, but giving them the tools to say, here are other models that you can use to go do that. And that's super important. And three, recognizing that people have views. I mean, Yelp works. So we should understand that we should know what's happening in communities real time and being able to feed that back into should something change because it's not working for people. So veterans is a great example. When something's not working for them, we should be able to take real-time feedback and saying, how do we change slightly? It doesn't mean you have to change policy, but you can change the way you approach a problem.
Yeah, and you guys, you took a lot of the heat for that.
Yes.
I know in the office, you said, hey, it's okay to fail.
Right.
You got to try and be able to fail. And that's not usually the way people think about a government. They're just trying to make sure that nothing goes wrong.
And nobody wants government to fail, right? Everybody's like, well, this is taxpayer dollars. Don't fail. I would say, I think we have to test out ideas because if we don't test and try and fail, and if we don't do it rapidly, we shouldn't take 10 years to fail. We should actually figure it out very rapidly to do that. Then we're not also being supportive of communities and citizens. We have to do better by our citizens. And the way to do that is to learn.
Yeah. Speak a little bit about incentives, Sonal, you know, how they need to be aligned, but sometimes how they are misaligned to solve our social problems.
Incentives are such an important part of how people solve problems. So, and you made a great point, Denver, about why government matters and the social entrepreneurs that come in. The government is the largest spender on social services in the world, in the United States, mm-hmm. in every city, in every state. I was just in Indianapolis last week. $26.2 billion is what the government spends on healthcare in just the city of Indianapolis.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Yeah.
Or the state. So if we're not addressing the government, it doesn't really matter. So incentives matter. So what are we paying for? Are we paying for the number of people that came into the health clinic or the number of people that were touched? Or are we actually paying for somebody not having to come back to a health clinic?
Mm.
So and if the incentive is I'll pay you if you get 1,000 more people in, or prisons are a great example, we pay per bed cost. So it's like a hotel room. The more people that are occupying the prison, the more effective it is economically. But that's not really what we want out of prisons. We want to rehabilitate people, put them back into community so they can be productive members of society. Why are we treating prisoners like hotel rooms?
Makes
and
no
not
sense.
Like we're solving problems. Similar with healthcare, why are we just filling beds in hospitals to say per occupancy rates, as opposed to saying, how do we ensure people don't come back with staph infections, people don't come back with more diabetes problems? How do we help people get better?
Yeah. And a good example you cite is what they've done with prisons in New Zealand, correct?
Correct. In New Zealand, the government actually took a very unorthodox approach, and Australia is also following this example of saying, if we're building and operating prisons and we're going to give it to the private sector, then they are going to get paid for reducing recidivism. We want to reform. You are going to get penalized if people don't get reformed, but you are going to get a benefit if you do reform.
Hmm.
And they do become productive members of society. So they changed the incentives, but it required the government looking at data differently. How often were people coming back? What were they coming back for? And it required the private sector to think about prisons differently.
Mm-hmm.
How do they train their wardens to help people leave a prison? How do they train their prisoners to actually reform and live within communities? And they incorporated, they worked with the business community, they worked with the community itself to see how to reform work effectively. And Serco, who runs it in New Zealand, is going around the world trying to figure out how do we close down prisons.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's an impressive, like, how many times do people go and say, I'm going to go around the world to see where prisons closed down and how they've done it well? That's an incentive change.
That's very smart. Speaking to the private sector, you have been a great champion of private-public partnerships as the most effective way to solve problems, and particularly in this era of constrained resources. How are these partnerships evolving, and what are some of the elements between just a normal partnership and one that is truly dynamic?
Yeah. Public-private partnerships have largely been in the past where the government pays the private sector to deliver a service that the government doesn't want to do or can't afford to do. Build a road, build a prison, go run it, and stay away from the government, then we'll manage the contract. The evolution of public-private partnerships is where the government is also at the table with the private sector to solve a problem. So New Zealand's a great example on prisons, but even in the Obama administration, Michelle Obama's work on food and healthy food, where companies came to the table and said, how could we provide food that's healthier? We'll look at the way we market food. We'll look at the way where we put food. Walmart changed the way they put healthier food up front so people would buy it. So there were lots of ways that the public sector highlighted what the options and opportunities were. They worked with USDA to change how to put plates of food differently, how to tell you what's healthy and what's not. Mm-hmm. And then on top of all of that, the companies came to the table and saying, we can do our part to make that work. But it was a partnership. It literally was a partnership. It wasn't the government telling the private sector what to do. It was really the private sector coming to the table and saying, how do we also participate in healthier food and healthier eating?
Got it. Innovative solutions are very, very nice, but they're usually not enough. What's needed is to unlock social impact at scale. How can philanthropy be smarter in helping us achieve that?
Philanthropy has one of the best abilities to be creative and innovative and, frankly, to take risk at the early stages, but then identify where scale needs to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what in the past, 101 of philanthropy scale was organizational scale. We're going to take this organization and scale it. But as you mentioned earlier, it's about policy shifts also. So how do we change policy for multiple organizations to be able to achieve scale, not just one organization?
Yeah, it's issues more than organizations.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And philanthropy is getting there, but I think really thinking about how do we shift the way we change from advocacy of an organization to advocacy for policy change that can have real scale and scalable impact, but also bring the private sector to the table, because the private sector is an important player in today's game. To assume that it's just the public sector and no private sector, it's not really the game we're in. We have to get the private sector. They are doing better distribution. They know how to get access to consumers. There's a way to bring the private sector to the table, and philanthropy has the ability to be that bridge.
Yeah, and I think it's going to have to take a change of mindset on the part of boards.
Correct.
Because we do live in this collaborative world. But our boards, Sonal, are set up as organizational boards. And they're looking at how much money did we raise, how many people did we serve. But if you're going to be dealing things on an issue basis in collaboration with others, you have to have, getting back to your metrics of success, they need to change. And that's going to take a while, but it's going to take some work.
It takes mindset shifts, right? It's also, we can make the organization change, but if the board is only measuring on how much money you raised, then all you're going to do is go raise money, as opposed to saying, how many collaborations did you build? How many more corporations are you working with? How are those relationships changing? We're not asking those questions. So it also, it requires a mindset shift.
Yeah. You know, along those same lines, we're not going to solve things, as we have been saying, along vertical axes anymore. It's going to have to take place across horizontal axes, which include different organizations, different disciplines, and different sectors. New way of thinking. But as part of that is breaking down silos. And it's easy to say we need to break down silos, but I can't think of anything more difficult in achieving than breaking down silos. What have you found that successfully addresses the issue of breaking down silos?
First, it's not easy to break down silos because people like to do their jobs and they get very good at doing their jobs. So it doesn't mean that they're bad at what they do and they don't want to make things different, but they also know how to do their job well. And accountability-wise, they don't want to get in trouble.
Yeah.
So we have to recognize that that's the mindset somebody is coming from. It's not because they don't want to do the right – they are doing the right thing by what they know. But to break down silos requires finding new solutions. And some of the best ways I've seen it is sometimes organizations create innovation units in the way we did at the White House that allowed people a place to learn and to think about how to do it and where to do it and give them experimental dollars, abilities to go do that, and the protection if something doesn't work to not get in trouble for it. And then as those things start to improve and get better, then incorporating it back into the system itself. The challenge that I think a lot of organizations face is they make the innovation unit its own thing. But they don't think about reintegration. And what companies do extraordinarily well, the ones that do it well, is they integrate it in.
Yeah.
So I'll give you an example. When Google bought DoubleClick, which was the sales mechanism, they integrated it into the company, or Google Maps was also bought. Google didn't create Maps. It bought a company that was doing it, and then they integrated it into Google. So thinking about, for nonprofits especially, how do we integrate those ideas in and not let the innovations become their own silo.
Yeah, they unsiloed him.
And, yeah, and so reintegration and integration is super important, and thinking about when those things work, how do we integrate it back into the system itself? And that's something that every organization that does it well has done that. They've integrated the ideas back into the system.
I know the Beck Center has studied all the new tools and approaches around financing that have come online over the past decade, impact investing, social impact bonds, development impact bonds. Do you think that the reality has lived up to the promise?
The reality is catching up to the promise. I think that would be the better way of saying it. It takes time for people to understand social impact bonds and how to do them and why it matters. You know, when I started and we started at the White House, it was just an idea. Held the first conference, people were like, oh, this is a really interesting idea. The last bill that just passed in Congress incorporated $100 million for social impact bonds. Yeah. So it's changing, and the reality is shifting.
If I can, just take a moment and tell us what social impact bonds are and pay for success.
Pay for success social impact bonds are really a way for the government to test out innovative ideas without paying for it up front. So philanthropy or the private sector puts up money if they believe a project is working. So I'll give you an example, an organization called Nurse Family Partnerships, a great organization. They've done a lot of work. Right. Yes, they have been on your show. And they've been doing really great work. And they know that if you send nurses out into communities, they have better outcomes on child and mother outcomes, mm-hmm. especially when they're pregnant. So they have proven this, and now they're running social impact bonds with cities and states saying, if we can prove that the outcomes are better than what you're getting now, the private sector will put up all of the money to do this. So for the nonprofit, like Nurse Family Partnerships, they get the capital up front. If it's $10 million, they get all of the $10 million to do that work, as opposed to piecemealing $5 million here, $1 million there. Yeah. They actually get the full $10 million. They get to work on it for 4 years. If it succeeds, the government will pay a return on that investment. So the government will pay the private sector back $10 million plus some percentage, 4%, 5%, mm-hmm. which isn't a huge amount of money. But actually, if you think about the risk that the private sector is taking, it's significant to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
And if that works, then the community benefits, the organization benefits, the city and the state benefit. And the government has taken on none of the risk. They've just paid for the outcome.
Very cool. You know, we've talked about the Office of Social Innovation, but many people forget at the end of that were the words and civic participation, a piece that I know you were equally focused on. What are some of the new civic engagement technologies that will allow citizens to have greater voice?
There are a lot of great organizations out there doing civic participation and getting citizens to engage, whether it's on bills in local communities, whether it is in actively engaging in local politics, whether it is engaging with policies and issues in their communities. But it requires vigilance.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that we've seen in civic organizations and civic participation, especially technologies, is it does really well for a period of time, and then it stops for a while. And as we all know, for anyone that's been there for a long time, it takes vigilance and a constant reminding people why this matters. Don't just do it for the election, but do it continuously,
right?
Because people's voices matter. I've seen this, you know, at very local levels. People win races by 100 votes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not 3,000 votes, not 5,000 votes. Your vote matters. But your voice also matters in Congress. Just 30, 40, 50 phone calls to your representative from your community makes a congressman or congresswoman listen to your views and your perspective. So understanding that matters, it's not about polarized politics. It's about your issues and what do you care about and making sure you're civically engaged. And democracy requires us as individuals to take our responsibility also seriously.
Do you think we are?
I think we're beginning to.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a shift going on here the last couple of years.
Yeah, last couple of years. But I think it's been happening, I'd say, for a while. I just think we've not paid attention to it. It's just happening at a more rapid pace. But I think people are voicing their opinions. I think you saw it in 2008. You saw it in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
People are voicing their opinions, and they're getting out there and really frustrated, angry. You may see it in elections, but we're just not listening to the noise everywhere else, and we should be.
Mm-hmm. You know, you are doing so many different things at the Beck Center, I don't even know where to begin. But I'm going to talk about a couple that caught my attention. You know, one of the things you learn early on in life is that if you ever want to do something, you have to imagine it first. You have to dream it. You have to see it in your mind's eye. It has to enter your consciousness before you can act on it. And that's the approach at the heart of the Beck Center's new Imagine series. Share with us what that's about.
You know, too often in the social sector, we're solving yesterday's problems. We're like, oh, that was a problem. How do we solve for it? But we don't imagine the future we want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And if the future we want to see is a world without homelessness, more people coming out of recidivism and living it, then we have to imagine what are those solutions for the future look like too? And where are the technologies? Where are the finance models? But it's an integrated process. I mean, it seems siloed when you look at our website. It's like you're doing finance or you're doing data and technology. But really, at the end of the day, we're solving a problem for a community and leveraging all of those different tools to do that.
Yes.
And it requires an imagination to say, we want the world to be different and we want to see and we can solve those problems. I think the social entrepreneurs get it, right? They become social entrepreneurs because they believe that they can solve a problem.
That's right.
And our job is to help them imagine how to do it and give them the tools and the abilities to get there.
One of the things that might make the world a little bit different is the blockchain. And you have something called the Blockchain for Social Good Project, tremendous possibilities as well as risks associated with the blockchain. What are some of the things you'll be looking at with this project?
So Blockchain for Social Good is a partnership with the Rockefeller Foundation. And our goal is to really think about how can we use blockchain effectively to help communities. So refugee populations who lose their identities, could we create an identity for them on a technology that allows them to carry it from where they are in the refugee camps to where they may live and stay over time? And refugees leave everything behind. Land titles. You know, why should there be multiple people within land titles? Mm-hmm. Can we put that on board? Can we take a picture? Can we give your name, your title, and all that and leave it there and not have everyone meddle in the process of that? Financial services. How do we make sure I can do direct financial services and I don't have to have multiple layers in
right.
between? So there's real opportunity for the blockchain. And what's interesting about the technology itself is that it doesn't require one trusted authority. It's multiple authorities who create the trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, for everyone, we are, again, it's part of civic engagement too, right? It's like we are now playing our role to make this truthful and make it work. And that is the potential for blockchain. It's huge. The vigilance in this is to make sure that the way the code gets written
mm-hmm.
is inclusive. So if I am already discriminatory and I put those discriminatory code into the system, then it has now become the code that everybody uses.
Gotcha.
And we see this with algorithms,
mm-hmm.
right? And we're, it's playing out in the public sphere today that if the algorithm is coded a certain way and we don't think about the biases we put in, then those biases become coded into a system. So the vigilance in the social good space especially is for those organizations that are using it to make sure we're asking the questions, whose data,
mm-hmm.
how does it get verified, who gets access to it, why are they getting access to it, are we authenticating it, are we verifying it? All of those questions are super important, but go into it with your eyes wide open. Don't go into it like this is a technology that's going to work, therefore we should just buy it off the shelf.
Right. Check all those assumptions. Well, everybody's talking about Bitcoin, but blockchain is the thing. So I'm looking at the list of Forbes list of 30 under 30, list of social entrepreneurs, and I say, holy cow, 8 of them were Georgetown students. That is quite an accomplishment, Sonal. Congratulations.
We are so excited at Georgetown that 25%, almost 25% of the students,
actually,
of the
over
young,
25%,
over 25
yeah.
of the young people selected on Forbes 30 under 30 were Georgetown students. And it just goes to the ethos of Georgetown,
mm-hmm.
which is really, what can you do, men and women, for others? What can we do to make society better, make our colleagues better, make our communities better? And it's exciting to see that that is also being recognized by Forbes and others. But our students are just incredible. I love working with them. And I have to say, I am so grateful that I graduated when I did, because I would never have gotten into college with this generation. But they're amazing. And some of them have come through the Beck Center. Others have been part of just the Georgetown ethos. And I am lucky to be a part of that.
Oh, fantastic. Well, as a founding executive director of the Beck Center, you've had the opportunity to create and shape the work culture there. How would you describe your corporate culture, and what makes it unique and distinctive from other places?
So it's taking a lot of the lessons from all of the places that I've worked over
mm-hmm.
the years. And we're an open culture. So if you come to our office at the Beck Center, it's an open space. It's like coming into a WeWork building. Everybody has access to everybody and doing the work that they're doing. We're also, the questions we ask of each other are open questions. So if you're in a staff meeting, everybody equally gets to sit at the table and have a perspective, and making sure that we can create the openness of the culture, but also getting used to being able to ask the tough questions of each other without being angry
mm.
and or mean. But really thinking about how do we create a culture that allows us to be critical and ask the deep questions, but at the same time, respectful of the work that others are doing. And that's the culture I want to create, and it's the culture I'd like to instill within the team that works there.
Healthy culture. Let me ask you about something completely different. A family business you started with your brother and sister. Well, actually, it's a nonprofit, and it's called IndyCore. Tell us about that journey.
So my parents are immigrants, and as we were growing up here, we've lived in dual cultures. So we're American.
Mm-hmm.
We have a heritage that's Indian. And what we wanted to do was think about how do we take everything that we've learned here from the United States and all the good learnings and apply it in another place of the heritage that we came from. So we created a Peace Corps for Indians. So how do Indians go back, participate in solving problems in communities, but at the same time realize what their dual identity means to them? We didn't want to tell everyone how to do it. We wanted them to do it through service.
Mm-hmm.
So we created the service culture. And when we first got there in India in 2001, 2002, the Indians would say, why are you wasting your time here? And today, as we look across India, which is almost 17 years later, people are saying service is a part of the culture of India. So we feel lucky to have been a part of the wave of that movement. And many of the people who graduated from IndyCore started organizations like Teach for India and other places that service has become an ethos in the country.
A very nice legacy. And it's still thriving. Let me close with this, Sonal. You've had such an extraordinary breadth of experience and have so many multiple perspectives. Maybe you can answer this question more thoughtfully than most. And that is, where is the world going today in social innovation? And what do you anticipate the next chapter is going to look like?
I think silos are beginning to break across the board. So you see it in media, you see it in society, you're seeing it in multiple places. I think the opportunity for social innovation is to recreate new institutional structures that have trust with society, trust with individuals, and try to solve for problems and be honest about it. How do we be authentic in our approach, make the mistakes, but be authentic about the problems that we face, and at the same time, build trusted structures that actually can work together with communities to solve problems? You know, as sometimes frustrating as it looks outside in the world, I actually think this is an opportunity to recreate that.
Mm.
And I think in social innovation, we're at the cusp of making that change, and we can really accelerate it.
Exciting times. Well, Sonal Shah, the executive director of the Beck Center for Social Impact and Innovation at Georgetown University, it was so great to have you on the show this evening. Your website is beckcenter.georgetown.edu, and Beck has two E's in it. If visitors take that trip, what kind of information are they going to find there?
They're going to find out about all the work we're doing and all the great students that are working with us and the changes that they're making. And hopefully they'll feed back into the process of what they're learning so we can also learn with them.
Great. Thanks, Sonal. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.